Welcome to the Maintenance Mavericks podcast, where we talk about trends in maintenance, reliability, and asset operations. My name is Ryan. I'm the CEO and founder of Upkeep, and I'll be your host for today. Today's guest, I got someone super special. We're super excited to welcome Jim Fleming to our podcast. A little bit about Jim. Jim is the co-chairman of ISM Data and Analytics Committee. He's the co-chairman of ISM Technology Committee and a senior faculty member at the Institute for Supply Management. He was previously at Intel for over 30 years across the engineering, manufacturing, and supply chain disciplines. Welcome to the podcast, Jim. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm doing really good.
All right. Well, again, really appreciate you joining us today. The way that we always kick off this podcast is to have you share a little bit more about your background and how you were first introduced to this industry of maintenance, manufacturing, and also supply chain. What's been your journey like in getting you to where you are today?
So I graduated with a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering and was hired by the Intel Corporation back in the mid-1980s. At that time, Intel was going through a transformation of being from a startup type of environment into a little bit more of a global high-volume manufacturing. And the things that they started to realize back then is you have to treat a global high volume manufacturing environment different than you treat a lab environment for a, you know, production tools, manufacturing tools. And in that realization, they started to reach out and hire manufacturing engineers to look at the discipline of process capability and also equipment availability. And that was my initial role into the company. And we had, you know, first assignment was taking a look at fleet availability across our global enterprise. And we had 7 or 8 different locations. One of the things that we were realizing is the forecasted output of those manufacturing facilities wasn't meeting the plan. And as they started digging into it, one of the things we started to find is the capital equipment, the production equipment, wasn't staying up at the anticipated rate. So it just wasn't running in production. The first assignment we kind of went through is to get a baseline around what does it take to, you know, what are truly the problems? And then we soon discovered there was no preventative maintenance process in place. So that was one of my first assignments for that initial year, is to drive a standardization of a preventative maintenance system into our global manufacturing. And I think at that time there were 800 or 900 pieces of capital equipment. And what we saw within 6 months of implementing that was approximately a 20% increase in manufacturing availability. And so our output started to match what the plan numbers were. That really was, you know, kind of the learning journey that Intel was going through, is that you can't treat science as just a lab environment. You really needed to bring in a manufacturing focus. And that was then brought into, you know, the wafer manufacturing capability. And they didn't just stand and say, you have process engineers and you have equipment engineers. They soon realized that you had to have a blend of both, because the process capability and stability was also a direct function of things that were going into maintaining equipment. And you could spend a lot of time trying to keep a piece of equipment up and running, but you would lose your process capability. And so by taking engineers and putting them into that space, that's one of the reasons that, you know, we figured out kind of a secret sauce around how do you maintain presence in different regions of the world and hit volume output at a rate that has never been seen before. So I spent about the first 20 years in that kind of environment. I was asked to kind of move into our supply chain organization. And the realization that was going through the company was, we have this organization that's been very transactional, and it was called procurement. There was a realization that you needed to take your procurement supply chain and treat it as a strategic initiative And we worked with, you know, large consulting firms. We started looking at benchmarks like Gartner Top 25, and soon realized we need to move out of a transactional and into a strategic environment. So I spent 10 years kind of working in that world, helping them, you know, move into truly treating the different facets and understanding your strategic initiatives around sourcing, contract management, supplier relationship management, and start to get enterprise resource planning systems that started to help give visibility. Had an opportunity to retire. And at that point, I was at a place in my career that teaching was a passion, and that brought me to the Institute of Supply Management. So now what I've done for the past 8 years is kind of work across the globe in helping corporations try to take this transformation in supply chain, but integrate it into the business and the enterprise. So that's a little bit about myself and my journey.
Thank you so much, Jim, for sharing your journey across, you know, maintenance, reliability, and, you know, uptime, downtime, all the way to, you know, tackling problems like supply chain, which is really where I wanted to take today's conversation. We're 3 years later into the start of the pandemic and COVID. And I feel like one of the big topics popping up on my newsfeed every single day was supply chain. I feel like the most pivotal moment was the Evergreen getting stuck in the Suez Canal, where supply chain was just literally on every single news channel, every single newsfeed. What happened the last 3 years with supply chain during COVID, after COVID, in the middle of COVID?
That's a great question. We've talked about this numerous times within the different networks that we have. And if you start to take a look at what has been occurring in supply chain, corporations starting in about the year 2005 through 2020 really started to acknowledge you have to treat them in a strategic nature. So you had to start looking at how do you optimize a supply chain? How do you treat suppliers in their unique perspective as a function of the risk that they bring and the financials that you spend with them? You had to take a look at, you moved away from, you know, negotiating with suppliers and just using a hammer to get what you wanted, and realizing you had to become a customer of choice. So this transition was occurring in the background. And what you started to see is that in the spirit of a lean environment, the corporations were starting to drive not only manufacturing into a lean environment, but they were driving supply chain into a lean environment. And when you have that lean environment, all of a sudden, as soon as you started having something, a constraint occur somewhere in your supply chain, you realize just how impactful it was. But the second reality is that companies realize we are now needing to treat this as a very, you know, big focus area. Because before it was kind of, yeah, we'll take supply chain, and yeah, they were purchasing, and yeah, they did purchase orders. They say they're strategic, they say they're optimized. And it was the day that people started running out of toilet paper in the grocery stores that all hell broke loose. And, you know, this is just general perception across the general public, but also the reality inside of corporations. We had been leaning out a supply chain. And when we were doing this thing called risk management, I remember this in my past saying, well, risk management, what if there was this thing known as a global pandemic? I can remember this conversation in 2010, 2015. And the response was, that'll never happen. And we started saying, okay, it won't, you know, and we kept refining and making things lean. When we had this thing that could never happen, all of a sudden happened, it broke the system. It really just, if you were to look at there was a book called The Goal, and it was written by, I think, Ellie Goldratt back in 1980. And he had this story about a journey of lean manufacturing. Talked about Boy Scouts climbing a hill with ropes attached. And as soon as the slowest person in that chain started to sit down, all of a sudden, the entire momentum broke. That's exactly what happened, is the chain broke. People started to look around and say, what's going on? And then we started reacting. We started bringing in the professionals within supply chain, inside of companies, inside of institutes like what we deal with. And we aren't the only one. There's institutes around the world. There's consulting groups around the world. We started to interject. Now, we found where the broken systems were and started to say, okay, it's going to normalize. But what we also predicted at the time is we went from this just-in-time inventory that was, you know, managing a very lean environment. When it broke, then they went into, oh, get all inventory possible. We went from a just-in-time inventory management to just-in-case. And we knew, and we started to predict that, that just-in-case, you know, everybody was buying everything they could, and just-in-case something else happened, as soon as things normalized out, all of a sudden the reality hit. We're back into the financial situation. Now I have too much inventory. It's hitting my bottom line, which hits my revenue, my profit margin outside of my revenue. And Wall Street started to see the impact. And so now we're in this oscillation between just-in-time inventory and just-in-case inventory. And one of the drivers that we're really trying to get people to focus on is find that sweet spot. And when you apply science within supply chain, that science allows you to set up an approach that will give you a little bit more optimization. The second reality is we are linked to the supply and demand curves, you know, the basic economic models, far more than people ever realize. So we have to think about our business of supply chain from a financial standpoint, to think like a business owner, but also like from an economist standpoint. Where are we at in the cycle? Where are we at with our suppliers? Where is the industry or economy sitting, and what can we do to quickly react? So that's a little bit about kind of what happened in the last 3 years. And people are starting to say, well, okay, it's kind of going away. Things are back into normal. But we're seeing disruptions today, like the war in Russia and Ukraine. We deal with organizations in Europe, and they're going through some significant pain points. We see things that are happening in other regions of the world, fires, earthquakes, you know, tsunamis, hurricanes, and they're having more disruption across supply chain. So it was a good things came out of the crisis. And I think that's one of the key, you know, messages we're trying to get across to people in supply chain and corporations is learn from what happened. Because as soon as you learn, you're starting to prepare for whatever that next unknown is into the future.
So maybe on that topic of like preparing for the unknowns, like if we're hindsight 2020, like what could have, should have we done? You know, because what I hear from you, Jim, is that, you know, there was this push towards lean and making sure that like we run as lean as possible. And obviously redundancies actually have a cost.
Yes.
And then there's this like 0.0001 chance that something catastrophic could happen.
Yep.
But if we obviously plan for this, like it increases costs, ultimately cost gets passed down to the end user, which, you know, is ultimately something that, you know, if someone else is willing to take that risk, mm-hmm. it's hard to operate that way. What could have, should have we done?
We within supply chain should be thinking more as business leaders, not supply chain leaders. We need to think about ourselves from an enterprise standpoint, and we need to create our ability to have these teachable points of view or elevator speeches that you can connect to your internal stakeholders to say, this is the reality. The second thing we are really working towards is helping people create that teachable point, but connect it to the language of the business. So when I can sit and work within my systems or my ecosystem of supply chain, and I can say this is an aggregate rolls up and impacts the balance sheet right here, which impacts my profit and loss statement right here, all of a sudden I can have a more educated conversation, not only with my internal stakeholders, but you know, up through the executive level, and also my external stakeholders, the suppliers and the customers. So we have had to step up our game to figure out not only how do you perform the science, but how do you communicate and influence the science? The second thing corporations really need to be thinking about, so that you learn from the past, is we need to truly think about risk management from an enterprise standpoint. And being able to kind of work for it. So, you know, what I used to see within companies, and I still do, you'll have individual departments that'll put together a risk management plan, and they send it to some centralized location, and nobody ever collectively looks at all of the different risk management plans and say, what's our enterprise risk? Mm-hmm. So we're learning now, companies are starting to say, okay, the manufacturing organizations are looking at supply chain risk management plans and vice versa. Engineering is doing the same. Finance is doing the same. Sales and marketing are doing the same. And when you look at this as a collective whole, you truly now start to see what are my business impacts. So that's the journey that we're on right now, is really trying to help corporations go down that path.
I mean, I completely agree. Like, you know, there's all these like reliability principles within, you know, our industry of maintenance reliability. And I've been pressing on this, like, you know, topic of bringing reliability principles into like how you look at the supply chain management as well, not just equipment malfunctions and equipment reliability, but supply chain reliability.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's a potentially contrarian view here. A lot of this is about like risk management. Mm-hmm. And there obviously is a cost to redundancy. But in the case of the COVID pandemic, like, you know, there's this 0.0001 chance that this thing came up. But in many ways, I do feel like the government bailed everyone out, even for not having these redundancies. I mean, is there truly an incentive to, you know, let's call it like, have these redundancies and think about risk management when, you know, we can always say, oh, you know, if that 0.001 chance happens, like, don't worry, the government will bail us out.
Yeah. And great point, because you're right. There are some organizations that are becoming complacent and say, well, we made it through that one. We learned we're good enough. What you're starting to see is organizations that are thinking in the spirit of best in class, best in world, and looking at benchmarks. And they're starting to truly, one of the other things that truly occurred in this past few years is lack of visibility into the depth of your supply chain. So visibility, when I have the opportunity to say, okay, I know where my primary suppliers are, but what about the secondary and the tertiary? Where are they located? And you're starting to see more expansion in technology systems and processes that are made available, where I'm gaining visibility and transparency into where is my supply chain. You then start to say, okay, what happens upstream from that? And we're driving suppliers into creating more visibility upstream. So we have systems today that are coming to market, artificial or AI-based systems that companies are bringing forward that are really starting to demonstrate how can you create more visibility into the system. One of the things that we probably didn't quite understand completely is most of our corporations said, well, I have a lot of suppliers and the system always seems to work, so things are good. One of the things that happened in COVID, we started to see, well, you may have a lot of suppliers, but on your critical items, how many suppliers do you have? And as you started to dig into it, they said, well, we had one, right? We had a single source. Why didn't you have more? Well, because nobody wanted to qualify that other one. It was too expensive to carry them. So they're putting in place, again, some of these scientific principles to say, I need to do segmentation of my supply base and start thinking about them from a spend or impact to the business from a financial. And on the second axis, it's a risk or complexity of the market. And it's called a Kraldrick matrix. And it looks at the supply base in a 2x2 matrix. And this was a program or a concept that was put, you know, brought forth by the McKinsey company years ago, and it still stands today. And when we work with companies, we start having them say, okay, where are your suppliers in this matrix? Now, your most strategic nature or strategic suppliers, the one with the highest spend and the highest risk, how many suppliers do you have? And you start to bring forward a list of principles and guidelines to say, you need to really be thinking about, if you have a single source here, where's your dual source? And the risk is so high that now you need to bring forward that visibility. So it's not just saying I go out and qualify extra suppliers for every supply base or every item I buy. It's doing it where it's the most strategic in importance. Mm-hmm. That's been a nice, you know, it really is starting to drive forward. The second thing is that people are realizing, again, the war in Ukraine, nobody's there bailing out those companies. And we're dealing with US-based companies that have had to shut down their enterprise segment in Ukraine because of what is going on, or in Russia. And nobody is there, you know, saying, we will take care of you, don't worry. So they're dealing with this harsh reality. They're also looking at some of the capability was put in and saying, this is now making a difference.
Yeah.
Look at what's happening. So the companies that are striving for excellence will start to learn and figure out, how do you go through that continuous improvement? And you see the same thing within reliability of equipment and or parts. You have to learn what is at optimal, and you have to put in some risk and reward mechanisms and then help people really understand what's going on. I think what happened early on, everybody defaulted to say, just get a bunch of inventory. Well, that was everybody, right? Sales and marketing. And when it came down and you put it into the dollars and cents, and you're able to show, here's what's going to happen on your balance sheet. It's coming. You saw this in this past Christmas season. Companies all over the world had excess inventory. They're trying to bleed it off. And so, you know, there's these economic cycles. We need to map towards economic cycles. We need to look at things as they're progressing and look into the future and not just react in the present. So that's one of the other things we're really trying to profess going forward.
Yeah. So one thing you brought up and is happening right now is this, you know, war in Russia, Ukraine, and the impact that it has to, you know, our supply chain here in the US. There's been a lot of talk about like bringing back manufacturing to the US, onshoring a lot of products, goods, services, so that we depend less on other countries.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, geopolitical issues. What are your thoughts on that? Very broad question again.
Ongoing conversation in supply chain professionals, right? We deal with chief procurement officers and chief supply chain officers from multi, you know, billion dollar corporations, and they're having that same conversation. Up front, it sounds like a very easy and novel concept. The reality is, when you start to look what our supply chain is consisting of today, people are now starting to see, oh my goodness, I didn't realize we had this much presence in Asia and in Europe and in different geographies. One of the things I think people have forgotten or made the assumptions, and their poor assumptions, is that we buy from those regions just because it's cheap.
Yep.
It's still junk. The reality is, it's not junk. These regions of the world are investing in infrastructure, technology, education, all kinds of things to kind of help enterprises grow. And they are very sophisticated. So they're providing not only a good price, they're providing a very high reliable source for corporations. And when you start looking around to say, where else do I have sources? You don't find them as prevalent as you know here in the Americas as you do elsewhere. So it's really nice to say, well, I would love to bring everything back. The incentive for a lot of these suppliers to relocate isn't there. So the big corporations start looking around and they're, you know, it might be easier for them to do it because they got the financial means. But you have these other suppliers, and the farther up the supply chain you get, the smaller the corporations become. They don't have that financial means to say, okay, I'm going to expand into this region. And you don't have small companies here that want to say or have the opportunity to expand to say, I'm going to provide that same good and service here in the domestic environment that I have. So we're finding a shift. You know, people are originally, we thought there'd be this huge influx away from Asian-based suppliers. It hasn't happened. It really hasn't. And we see some more nearshoring where there are some locations that are coming, instead of back to the US, they're coming into, you know, the Latin Americas. And that helps a little bit, but there's still, at the end of the day, this economic factor. Cost is an overarching driver. And when corporations are held, especially publicly traded ones, to quarterly profit and loss statements reported out into the stock market and the impact of the stock market, you know, goes up and down, you still come back and say, I need to have my lowest cost and I need to have capability. So, and I'm still getting it from these different regions. And you don't see that growth rate here more domestically or back onshore that we had hoped. And I, honest to goodness, don't know that I see that momentum happening. So companies are truly starting to say, how do I optimize my supply chain? How do I understand where they're at? How do I transport them? How do I maybe go through distributors or a segmentation around where is inventory located? I don't always have to have inventory at my site. I'll set up strategies to have maybe inventory somewhere halfway. And we're working with suppliers, and suppliers are willing to carry the burden of holding onto that inventory for us. So you're starting to find, you know, both ends of the spectrum looking for that optimal, you know, lean line.
So what I hear from that, Jim, is like, you know, we originally had this grand vision of bringing everything domestically, building manufacturing, you know, pulling all of our supplies domestically here in the US. But in reality, you know, there's still a heavy reliance on, you know, outside countries, you know, let's call it China, Asia. This is what's going on through my mind right now. A hypothetical scenario, geopolitical tensions continue to rise between the US and China, there is a very, very, very heavy impact to the supply chain if that were to happen. Maybe the question is like, what happens, I mean, to our supply chain? I mean, is it
great
is
question?
One of these like 0.001% chance catastrophes?
So what we've seen is a shift in the way people look at risk management. Risk management used to just be, you know, the source, it dries up, something breaks. It was mainly about the item or the service. Now what you see is the factors that are going into risk management are things like geopolitical issues. People within corporations at the executive level have finally started to say, this is a reality. When they see the dependency they have on a supply chain, and they understand it, at least they're starting to say, we need to continue to be aware of it. So what you have is we are now seeing companies that maybe they can't find supply base back here in the US or in the Americas, but they're looking in other regions of the world. And they're starting to find, in some cases, you know, other regions within Asia, within the, you know, within India area, within Europe, even starting to see some expansion down into Africa. They're starting to say, okay, where is an alternative beyond that region? And that becomes a risk factor. So geopolitical risk factors are now more heightened. Doesn't mean it prevents us, because there are some things that we get, you know, the certain minerals that are available. And those minerals are predominantly in a region, China. 90% of the global supply is there. So if we continue to go down that path and say we are dependent on that in a geopolitical, we're starting to see some internal redesign within corporations to say, okay, what can I do to theoretically design that need out of my system? So you're looking at, you know, high-tech corporations are starting to invest in getting away from some of those minerals and saying, can I do it with other sources or other minerals that exist? And corporations are, you know, I can tell you right now, in a 10-year period, when I was in supply chain at Intel, we went from managing supplies and suppliers that covered 15% of the elements on the periodic table. In 10 years, we went up to managing 55% of all elements on the periodic table, because you are getting, you know, sophisticated. You have people that are engineering new solutions. And so we're at least starting to say, what's the possibility? I might not be able to buy that exact widget, but what can we do internally with our R&D folks to say, let's find an alternative or design it out altogether? So it's causing us to integrate supply chain back upstream inside of a corporation up into research and development. That in the past was something that, you know, supply chain or purchasing said, oh, they won't let us in the door. You can't accept that anymore. You have to be looking at full life cycle of product lines and coming up with strategies that manage it from the R&D to the ramp to the end of life cycle within, to optimize everything across your internal supply chain.
I mean, we've been talking quite a bit about, you know, potential catastrophes and, you know, risk. Let's talk about the future, Jim. What happens over the next 5 years? Tell me about what kind of like trends you're seeing in supply management. You know, how important is technology in all of this?
Great question. So that is, you know, one of the fortunate items I have is to be able to lead two of the, you know, global committees that we have within the Institute of Supply Management, and that's data and analytics and technology. Technology is coming. Technology, you know, as much as people would like to say, you're never going to truly be able to replace people, it's coming. We need to, instead of looking at it from a fear base, we need to start saying, we need to start accepting that reality and building our workforce so they have those capabilities. ISM, along with our research center, CAPS Research, that is aligned to Arizona State University, we came up with somewhat of a vision of supply chain in the year 2030. And it looked at where we were at 2-3 years ago. And of the end-to-end supply chain, there were generally about 38 discrete elements or processes. At the year 2030, 85% of those are going to be automated. Today, you know, or a couple of years ago, it was predominantly 100% of the, you know, needed human beings in there. So it's coming. Artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, blockchain, artificial intelligence. We're seeing autonomous vehicles. All of these things are actually starting to come into our supply chain and will continue. And it drives visibility and it drives transparency. We will, by tapping into that infrastructure, we're really going to be able to make sense. Now, the challenge we have, first of all, is what is the right technology to buy? What we see with companies, they're buying all these things and they say it doesn't work. You have to step back and say, what are you putting into the system? The data, to make a decision and work with technology, it has to have good data going in order to have good data coming out. Most companies today are dealing with garbage in, and the technology provides garbage out. And then they say, well, we need to get a new technology. We're seeing more and more companies that are starting to say, we need to clean up that data set coming in and have it standardized. So there's this balance between data and analytics and technology that is truly needing and is coming together to drive that. The next trend that's coming out that I think a lot of us are starting to see in general, you know, advertisements and commercials and stuff like that is sustainability. So as we head into a carbon neutral environment, supply chain plays a very large portion of that. You'll see things that are known as a scope one, scope two, and scope three around carbon emissions. And you'll hear more of that in the next few years. And that just defines where in your supply chain are you seeing carbon emissions being generated. So a scope one is what's generated inside of a company. A scope two is what's generated with the immediate infrastructure supporting that company. And a scope three is your supply chain. 70% of the impact of your carbon footprint is in scope three supply chain. So I need to work with suppliers that are working on sustainability. I need to work with suppliers and on up the food chain in order to gain true, clean, sustainable supply chains and sources going forward. So those are the big major trends that we see coming and our main themes that we have at our annual conference every year that really are saying, what can we do? And it's a challenge. Companies of all sizes are trying to figure out, how do you continue to make progress? So incrementally, everybody's moving forward. We have some that are striving for excellence, and you have to take some risks at times. So, you know, again, it's that risk and reward. Sometimes I'm going to buy something or do something that may not give me what I need, but I have to have a risk tolerance to say, okay, I learned, I failed, and I'm going to learn to the next level, and I'm going to go. Instead of coming back and saying, I'm risk adverse, I'll wait for somebody else to figure it out, and then I'll go forward. Yeah. You'll have the full spectrum, but those are the things that are coming in the future.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing all of your insights here, Jim. Really appreciate it. I personally learned a ton, as I'm sure, you know, a lot of our guests did as well. The way that we always close our podcast is a round of quickfire questions to leave our audience with you extra golden nuggets of information. So I'll ask you a short question. Get your thoughts in 20 seconds or less. You ready?
Okay.
All right. So to start, what do you think is the biggest challenge that companies are facing in supply chain right now? And how are they tackling it?
We have too many companies today that still don't believe it's a strategic value. So they're still holding on to transactional people and say, I'm going to just throw low-paying people or lower-paid people and less skilled people and throw them at it instead of going out and finding experts and scientists in that world and bringing them in. Big challenge.
All right. What about one question you wish that I had asked you and how would you have answered?
So I think the thing really comes back that one of the challenges that we're dealing with today is how do you create, and it would go very much into even the world that you're dealing with, how do you create that language, consistency, and continuity? So companies predominantly are driven by the financials. An enterprise is there to make money. We need to figure out how to everything that we do link into that enterprise or that language so we can understand what we're trying to do, how it impacts it. We can be more sophisticated and make smarter choices the better we do. So we have to all, I know people say, I don't want to, you know, finance, they're a bunch of, they're the enemy, right? They're not the enemy. They really do have a language we need to understand and acknowledge and partner with.
All right. Contrarian views. You may have answered this one already, but what's one thing about supply chain that you believe that many others may disagree with you on?
As I continue down this and work in kind of evangelical way, we are seeing a transition in technology, a transformation in technology. It's coming. I lived in a world of high tech. I watched when entire factories that used to have people running them were basically automated and sophisticated processes, and you could go to a lights out factory. People at one time said, it can't happen. It won't happen. Watching it emerge, and people have to look out there, see it coming and say, it's not perfect. And it never is going to be perfect. There's all these things that are building, but I have too many people that keep looking at me like, Jim, your supply chain isn't Intel, right? Technology's everywhere.
All right. Biggest takeaway that you hope all of our listeners will learn from today's discussion?
I really hope people acknowledge and understand a supply chain is a critical element of an enterprise's performance. You have to look at it as a whole system and not as a subset of the system. So as you go forward, one of the first things you need to do is understand your impact to both the bottom line, and that can be looked at from inventories, cost of goods sold, overhead, into the top line. What can I do to bring products to market sooner to generate more revenue? What can I do to get suppliers to help me bring new ideas forward? And profit. And we play in those three, in the cost factor, the revenue factor, and profit factor. Okay. You keep that in mind, understand it. The rest of this is going to be easy for you.
All right. Thank you so much, Jim. I, again, learned so much from you in this short 30 minutes. The last but not least, could you share with all of our listeners the different ways that they can connect with you and follow you on your journey?
You can reach out to the Institute for Supply Management, which is at ismworld.org. You can reach out to me at jfleming@ismworld.org. You can follow me on LinkedIn and/or connect through your network and reach out to myself.
All right. Thank you again, Jim, for joining us. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to today's episode of the Maintenance Mavericks podcast. Again, my name is Ryan. I'm the CEO and founder of Upkeep. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm very, very active. Or you can shoot me an email directly at ryan@upkeep.com. I hope everyone enjoyed today's episode, and I look forward to the next one. Until next time, thank you again, Jim. Have a great rest of the day.